Hello, friends. This is Out of This World Radio with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting live from the studios of KKNW on 1150 AM here in beautiful Bellevue, Washington, just outside Seattle in the United States. The purpose of this program is to raise consciousness and make this world a much better and happier place. And I know that with everyone's help, we can and will make this earth a better place. I want to thank everyone so much for making Out of This World Radio one of the most popular talk shows in the Seattle area and the fastest growing metaphysical and spiritual radio program in the world with over 200,000 listeners in over 80 countries. During the first hour from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. today, Seattle time, I'll be interviewing Professor Rupert Sheldrake, a wonderful man who I consider an incredible scientist. He's a biologist and the author of more than 85 scientific papers and 13 books. He was among the top 100 global thought leaders for 2013, as ranked by the Detweiler Institute in Zurich, Switzerland. He's now visiting Seattle, and so happy he'll be with us today. During the second hour from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Seattle time, I'll be interviewing another fascinating gentleman named Billy Woodard, as well as his father, Zora, from the Hollow Earth. A few days ago, I just returned from Mount Shasta, which contains many incredible portals to the ancient Lemurian civilization in the Hollow Earth and Telos, as well as the ancient city of Shambhala. I think you'll find his interview really fascinating and out of this world. Before we start, I'd like to thank everyone's support for this radio program, because Out of This World Radio is a nonprofit program supported entirely by donations. And for those who'd like to donate, please go to the donate button at the upper right-hand corner of the program webpage at outofthisworld1150.com and just click on it. I really appreciate your help and support, because I know together we can create a much better and happier world. I also like to thank the many sponsors of this show, and we're also looking for sponsors and advertisers. Any advertising on the program would have a worldwide audience for your goods and services. I also would like to thank my dear friend Carol, who's designing my website and providing wonderful support, my friends in the Galactic Alliance who've been supporting my show, my angelic and earthly family, and of course Eric at KKNW, without whose help and support would not be possible. I have a spiritual mentoring program for those interested, where I teach people how to contact their angels and spirit guides. If you'd like to get in touch with your loved ones who've passed on, or to contact your guides and get some good spiritual advice, please send me an email to outofthisworld1150@gmail.com, or you can call me toll-free in the United States and Canada at 1-888-879-8339, or on my cell at 509-750-9793. Also, if you missed my Galactic Conference, Wisdom Conference a few months ago, you can order the audios and some videos of the conference for just $97. If you're interested, please send me an email to outofthisworld1150@gmail.com. My next conference will be held at the same location in Olympia, Washington, from April 12th to the 16th, 2019. And if you register soon, there's a substantial discount for early registration of just $55 for the entire conference. If you're interested, please send me an email. Also, this summer, from September 6th to the 12th, 2018, I'll be taking a group of people to Mount Shasta, Telos, and the Hollow Earth. The trip is filling up, but there's still room for people to come along. I've been sponsoring trips to Mount Shasta and Telos for the past 2 years, and it's an incredible place. I just returned to Seattle a few days ago from one trip, and we had an incredible time. The Sasquatch visited our campsite, and we saw them actually in the forest walking by our campsite, as well as they also built a peace mandala made out of sticks and twigs, as well as a clear, beautiful rose quartz crystal, which they placed within this mandala and also around the trees around our campsite. So it was an amazing experience. The cost for the trip is only $200 and includes free dry camping on Mount Shasta, right next to one of three or four different entrances to Telos in the Hollow Earth. For people coming, they recommend that you not eat any meat for at least 3 weeks before the trip. And if you're interested, please send me an email to outofthisworld1150@gmail.com. Tomorrow, on Saturday, July 14th, Michiko Hayashi, who's with me here in the studio today from the Emoto Peace Project, will be giving a presentation with Josh and Adam Bigelson about how we can heal ourselves with the right Haudo vibration or thoughts. The name of the talk is called Emotions and How They Relate to Health and Wellness, and it'll be held at the Vitamin Life Center at 15830 Redmond Way in Redmond, Washington. Their phone number, if you need directions, is 425-869-7000, or toll-free at 866-998-8855. After that, she'll be also speaking at the wonderful Crystal Spirit Center in Tacoma, just off 38th, at Cedar, near to the Tacoma Mall, tomorrow from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. And her talk will be on a message from water and how to devices, how it can be utilized as a preventative therapy. She'll also be doing vibrational sessions after her talk. And with that, I'd like to welcome Professor Rupert Sheldrick. And he's a wonderful man. He just came into Seattle. He'll be here for a few days. Professor Sheldrick, hi, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Oh, good. It's so good to have you. Did you just get in yesterday?
Yesterday evening, yes.
Oh, you must be a little jet-lagged today.
Oh, yeah, I feel fine, actually. I'm staying with some friends on the outskirts of Seattle, and the only thing that disturbed my sleep was the cocks crowing this morning. So that was quite an exciting way to be in Seattle.
Well, Rupert, they were probably using some sort of morphic resonance with you to let you know that they're welcoming you to Seattle, and they're very happy you're here.
Mm.
So, anyway, you've done some incredible work, and one of the things, of course, you're known for morphic resonance. Could you explain that concept for my listeners who don't who might not know what it means?
Yes, it's really the idea that there's a kind of memory in nature.
Okay.
That the whole of nature has a sort of memory. The laws of nature are more like habits. Each species has a kind of collective memory. Each individual draws upon it and contributes to it. It's a bit like Jung's idea of the collective unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a scientific hypothesis which can be tested scientifically, has been tested, and seems to fit the facts pretty well,
mm-hmm.
Better than any alternative anyway. The theory predicts, for example, that if rats learn a new trick in Seattle, then rats all over the world will be able to learn the same thing quicker just because the rats have learned it here. So it's the idea that there's a transfer of memory, and the process by which this memory is transferred is called morphic resonance. The word morphic comes from the Greek word morphe, meaning form.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about shape, pattern, or order. It's a kind of resonance of self-organizing patterns across space and time.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, I know you can't, you're not here with us in the studio, unfortunately, Rupert, but I'm so glad you could appear by telephone today. With me in the studio today, visiting, is Michiko Hayashi. She's with the Emoto Peace Project in Tokyo, and she used to be the administrative assistant to Dr. Masaru Emoto for over 10 years until he passed away in 2014. And the reason why I'd like to bring her in now briefly is that I know she's talked about how Dr. Emoto used to talk about in their research about the 100th Monthly effect. And Michiko, could you explain a little bit about that, how if you remember that a monkey on one island would learn a new technique of washing coconuts, and then monkeys all the way across the Pacific would suddenly have the same idea about washing coconuts in the ocean before eating them.
Hi, Ted.
Hi.
Hello, Dr. Sheldrake. This
Hello.
Is Michiko from Dr. Emoto's office.
Good to meet you on the air.
Well, good to meet you too. I've been wanting to talk to you too, and I'm so grateful and honored to be here to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Mm.
Well, about 100 monkey phenomena, I think Ted has explained mostly, so I really don't have to say much, but it's just the effect how at the breaking point things will happen suddenly with the action that anything does. When it gets to a certain point, everybody else does it, and we can't even explain how that goes. But Dr. Emoto used to say it's because water has memory and transmits information that goes all over the world beyond time and space instantaneously.
Yeah, so. Interesting. It reminded me of Professor Sheldrake's example of the rats in
mm-hmm.
Seattle learning something new here, mm-hmm. and then rats all over the world.
Oh yeah,
learning the same thing. You've come out your latest book is called Science and Spiritual Practices: Transformative Experiences and Their Effect on Our Bodies, Brains, and Health. And the quick excerpt of it, say you write, the effects of our spiritual practices are now being investigated scientifically as never before. And many studies have shown that religious and spiritual practices generally make people happier and healthier. And then you go into a series of different areas, meditation, gratitude, connecting with nature, relating to plants, rituals, singing and chanting, and pilgrimage in holy places. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your work, Professor Sheldrake.
Yes, well, this is my latest book. It's not actually out yet in the U.S. It's out in Britain, but mm-hmm. comes out here on August the 28th.
Oh, great.
So really what it is about this extraordinary convergence between science and spirituality that's happening at the moment. People have often thought that they're in conflict or opposed to each other, but both the spiritual practices and science are about experience. The Greek word empirical means experience, and spiritual practices are about spiritual experiences. And what I'm writing about in this book is scientific studies of these practices and the experiences that go with them. For example, meditation, which has now been investigated scientifically, hundreds, actually more than 1,000 published papers on meditation, on its effects, on the effects on the brain, on the physiological effects. More than 18 million Americans now meditate. So this is something where this is a very traditional spiritual practice. It's present in all religious traditions. And yet these scientific studies illuminate how it's working in a way that no one knew before. Gratitude is another one I deal with in my book. There's now a lot of investigations that show that people who are grateful, who make a practice of being grateful, are happier and better liked by others than people who are not. And it's not just something fixed, it's something you can actually practice. So in my book, I discuss simple practices anyone can do. So the reason I'm doing this is because I'm a scientist. I also practice these practices myself. Both science and spiritual practices are key parts of my own life. I'm exploring some of them, by the way, tomorrow at a workshop at East West Books. But the point of this is that the quite simple practices can have very significant effects on one's health and well-being.
Wonderful. Well, just wonderful. If you don't mind, I know that I'm going to bring Michiko in just real quick for a few seconds, because Michiko, you've talked so many times about love and gratitude. Could you give like 5 seconds on gratitude?
Sure. Well, water is showing how beautiful the energy of gratitude is. When we show the word thank you to water, it forms a beautiful crystal form at the molecular level. So when we are in the state of gratitude, saying thank you to, feeling thank you to everything we see or experience, to people or food, just don't take it granted, but just feel the gratitude. Say thank you to every small, even tiny small things. That gives us joy and happiness and feeling that we're alive, grateful for being alive. That really gives a beautiful energy. That's something that we can learn from water, too.
Wonderful. Thank you, Michiko. Mm-hmm. One thing, too, I've watched your TED Talk recently. That was recently banned by TED Talk, and I thought that was unfortunate. And you talk about, there's so many ways to go, Professor Sheldrake. On the science, your talk, if you hope you don't mind me bringing this up, about the science delusion. And you list 10 dogmas of science, and I'd love to have you discuss those. I could list them, go over them one by one with you, but it's just fascinating what your talk was about.
Okay, well, this was the theme of my book, which in Britain is called The Science Delusion. In the U.S., the same book is called Science Set Free, mm-hmm. Now available in paperback. And what I do is discuss the 10 basic dogmas of contemporary science. These are dogmas that are assumptions that scientists make. They very rarely discuss them. Scientists often go on about the need to be skeptical, and I completely agree with that. But I think we also need to be skeptical about the assumptions of science itself. I call this radical skepticism, not just attacking things you don't agree with, but looking at the assumptions on which science itself is based.
Right.
And it turns out that there are 10 basic assumptions in science, and I'll just mention them briefly. Mm-hmm. The first is that nature is mechanical. Everything's machine-like. In other words, universe is a machine. Animals and plants are machines. We're machines. Our brains are computers. Our hearts are pumps, and so on. This is an assumption that's dominated science since the 17th century, when the mechanistic revolution occurred. Mechanistic means to do with machines. So it's basically using a machine metaphor for all of nature. And as I argue in my book, it's only a metaphor. It's not a scientific theory you can actually prove. And in many cases, the metaphor of an organism is better. The whole universe now looks much more like a growing organism than like any kind of machine that we ever conceived of. The second assumption is that matter is unconscious, that the universe is made of matter, material reality, and all this matter is unconscious. So when we look out at the universe, the sky, everything we see is unconscious. Mm-hmm. Everything on Earth is unconscious, except for human brains and maybe the brains of other animals and possibly extraterrestrials on other planets. So this is very different from all traditional cosmologies, which have seen nature as alive and the stars as conscious beings, the Earth as alive, as Mother Earth, and animals and plants as truly alive, as living beings. So that's the second assumption. Mm-hmm. And it leads to terrible problems, because if you assume everything's unconscious and that we're made of matter like everything else, then the very existence of human consciousness is a terrible embarrassment for science, and it's called the hard problem. We ought not to be conscious, and some philosophers of mine try to pretend that we're not.
Right.
The third assumption is that the laws of nature are fixed, and I think, in fact, they're more like habits as mm-hmm. a result of what I call morphic resonance, the memory of nature. I think the laws of nature evolve along with nature. In fact, I think they're habits that evolve rather than laws.
Mm-hmm.
The next assumption is that nature is purposeless. There's no purpose in evolution or in the universe. And that's just an assumption that follows from the metaphor of the machine. Machines have no purpose of their own. They only serve the purposes of people who use them. The next assumption is that the total amount of matter and energy is always the same.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment of the Big Bang, all the matter and energy in the universe that exists came into being all at once from mm-hmm. in a single instant.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this is just an assumption. And in fact, as I show in my book, astronomers and cosmologists have increased the amount of matter and energy in the universe more than 20-fold in the last few decades. First of all, they've invented dark matter to explain the behavior of galaxies.
Rupert, if you could, speak up a little bit, please, just to make sure we can hear you okay.
Oh, sorry about that.
That's
can you
okay.
hear me now?
Just fine. Yes, my friend. Yes,
is that
fine.
Better?
Yeah, that's much better. Yeah, thanks.
Okay. So they've astronomers and cosmologists have come up with the idea of dark matter enormously increasing the amount of matter in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
There's no evidence for this apart from the fact it makes their equations balance.
Mm-hmm.
And dark energy is now a part of standard cosmology for making the universe expand.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of dark matter and energy is now 96% of reality.
Mm-hmm.
Regular matter and energy is only 4%. So how can we be sure that this total amount of 4% is fixed?
Right.
Does the total amount of dark matter and energy change? No one knows.
I have to ask you after this about the speed of light. I watched an interview where you talked about that. It was fascinating, but please continue.
Well, I was just going through these 10
sure.
dogmas.
Yes,
I'll come
go ahead.
Back to that, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, well, I'll speed through the rest.
That's okay. You don't have to go light speed. Go ahead.
No. The other one, the next one, is the idea that everything to do with biological inheritance is material.
Mm-hmm.
In the genes or in epigenetic modification of the genes.
Right.
And so I already said, I think a lot of our inheritance comes through morphic resonance. What the genes do is code for proteins.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't explain the great majority of inheritance. I give the reasons why in my book, Science Set Free, all based on scientific peer-reviewed literature. The next assumption is that memories are stored in the brain. And I don't think they are. I think the brain's more like a tuning system, more like a radio receiver than like a video recorder. Because I think memories work by morphic resonance, by a kind of resonance process across time.
Mm-hmm.
The next assumption, number 8, is that minds are inside brains, nothing but the activity mm-hmm. of brains. Whereas I think there's no evidence for this. I think our minds are much more extensive than our brains. They stretch out through fields into the world around us. Again, I give the reasons for thinking that. I'm just giving a very brief summary at the moment.
That's all right. Talk as long as you like. I really enjoy listening to you.
You'd like to go back to the speed of light?
No. No, there's one more.
There's two more assumptions.
Yeah, go ahead. Two more, yeah.
One is that psychic phenomena are illusory. Things like telepathy are impossible, therefore they don't exist. That's a very common assumption among people who say they're heavily into science. But it's a very unscientific assumption. It's only an assumption that right. if the mind's nothing but the brain, it can't possibly affect another mind hundreds of miles away.
Right.
Whereas if the mind extends beyond the brain invisibly, just like the broadcasts from a cell phone extend beyond a cell phone, which is, I think, how minds work, I think they in brains, but they stretch out far beyond them, just like the influences of cell phones are in cell phones but stretch out beyond them. Then things like telepathy are quite possible, and there's a lot of evidence for it. So the assumption it's impossible, I think, is just a dogma. And finally, there's the assumption that mechanistic medicine is the only kind that really works. Regular medicine based on physics and chemistry, surgery and drugs, is the only valid kind. And all alternative and complementary therapies are kind of illusory, if they work at all, it's only through the placebo effect. The problem is the placebo effect itself is unexplained. The effect of mind over body and healing ought not to happen, according to regular science. So we've got here a set of 10 assumptions on which normal science is based, but they're all assumptions, and each one of them could be, and I think it actually is, wrong. And I think that when we question them and go beyond them, we open up a whole new set of possibilities for science. I'm not anti-science, I'm totally pro-science. I've spent my whole career doing scientific research. I just think that it's very frustrating the way science at present is boxed in by these mm-hmm. dogmatic assumptions. And that's why my book's called Science Set Free, because setting science free from these assumptions, I think, would liberate a new era of creativity.
I couldn't agree with you more, Rupert. I know I read your blog about Wikipedia under threat. You wrote, people, quote, with their own agendas, keep trying to take Wikipedia over. Skepticism, you write, is a normal, healthy attitude and doubt. Unfortunately, it can be used as a weapon to attack opponents. And I think it's a shame that apparently a small group of people were able to have your talk banned from TED Talks discussing what you said now. I think it's the points you made are extremely valid and very, very interesting as well. And I think third dimensional science in this world needs to reexamine their dogmas if they truly want to find the truth of what's going on in this universe.
Well, that's the point. You see, I think science should be a method of inquiry, not a belief system.
Right.
And unfortunately, for some people, it's become a belief system.
Mm-hmm.
There are a whole lot of internet trolls, the kind of people who've taken over big chunks of Wikipedia and are editing it mm-hmm. in a most biased way. They think they already know the truth. They're believers in the scientific dogmatism. I think they're doing science a great disservice, actually. And so are the people who got my talk banned from TED. They're dogmatic believers in this kind of religion of science.
Sure.
I think TED, and I regret banning the talk because it didn't do them any good at all. And when my talk was banned, it had 35,000 views. It's now had about 5 million. So it's actually made it one of the most discussed talks in the whole of the history of TED.
Well.
So it was counterproductive from their point of view.
Sure. Well, my name is Ted, of course, and we're having our own TED Talk today, and I promise I'm not going to ban you. because I like what you do and find you're a fascinating guy. And don't worry, this is not going to be banned by any TED Talk. I'm not going to ban it. So, well, I've been for the last couple of minutes, it's been on the tip of my tongue. I heard your interview and I read some things about your speed of light. Tell my listeners around the world about the speed of light. It's a fascinating story, Rupert. It's really interesting.
Well, this is one of the things I discuss in Science Set Free, under the assumption that the laws of nature are fixed, because that assumption extends to the constants of nature, the so-called fundamental constants, like the universal gravitational constant, the charge on the electron, the speed of light, and so on. And what I do is actually look at the evidence. So, is the speed of light really fixed?
Right.
Let's look at the data. If we look at the data showed that the speed of light dropped by about 20 kilometers per second all around the world between 1920 and 1950 or thereabouts.
Sure. Wow.
And then it went up again.
Wow.
And the people who were measuring it all around the world were showing very, very small errors, you know, only 1 kilometer per second, far less than the 20 kilometers per second it had dropped. So this wasn't, according to the data, just a matter of error.
Right.
But then when it went up again, all around the world, people got the same kind of results, again, very close to the agreed value at the time.
Right.
But this episode, when it dropped by 20 kilometers per second, suggests the speed of light could actually vary. So when I talk to experts in physics and on experts on the constants about this, I said, well, could the speed of light actually vary? And they said, no, of course not, because it's a constant. I said, but the data show that it varies.
Right.
And then they said, oh, well, we just don't pay much attention to the data, you know, because there must have been something wrong with them.
Huh.
I said, you mean all these labs all around the world were getting the same results just because they wanted to get the same as everyone else?
Right.
They were fudging the results. And this expert said, well, we don't like to call it fudging. We prefer a more delicate phrase. I said, well, what's the more delicate phrase? He said, we call it intellectual phase locking. So I said, okay, well, they're all intellectually phase locked. So if we can't trust the data because scientists are adjusting the data to what they think they ought to get, how do we know if it's the speed of light varies or not? Then he said, oh, well, this was so embarrassing. He said, we've got round that problem. I said, how? He said, well, in the 1970s, we've defined the speed of light. We've just stated what it is. And we've defined the units it's measured in, like the meter, in terms of light. So if the speed of light does change, you'd never notice because the units change as well. So I found this quite extraordinary. Anyway, this is one of the things I talked about in my band TED Talk.
Go ahead, yeah.
And so the speed of light is now fixed by definition, but the constant that's most variable, always has been, is the gravitational constant, the universal gravitational constant. And my proposal is a very simple one. I'm just suggesting that all around the world there are people measuring this constant. What happens at the moment is that in each lab they average the results. If there's any results that don't fit to what they think it ought to be, they discard them. They call them outliers and just discard them. And then some international committee averages the results from all the different labs around the world that have already been averaged. And again, any that don't fit, they discard them. That's how they come up with the value of the universal gravitational constant. They revise it every few years. My point is this. Instead of averaging the results, if all the labs around the world published their results online, we could see whether the errors were correlated. I mean, are they all up, say, in July 2018, and were they all down in July 2017 or December 2016? They may fluctuate together, and if they do, it may tell us something about the environment through which the Earth is passing as the whole galaxy, as the whole solar system moves through the galaxy. It's perfectly possible that local conditions in the galaxy that would affect the gravitational constant. But we'll never find out if there's this attempt to suppress any variations in the measurements to fit with the dogma that it's always got to be exactly the same, even though the data show it's not.
Forgive me, with all due respect to these so-called scientists, it's almost like they're voodoo priests of some kind. They're acting upon, they're making their so-called scientific findings as if they were a religious dogma, that you can't question that.
And well, that is the problem, you see. It's
sure.
become much more, it's actually more dogmatic than religion.
Right.
Because in religion, you've got, if you're a Christian, if you don't like the Catholics, you can become a Baptist or a Methodist or an Episcopalian.
Sure.
If you don't like Christianity, you can become a Buddhist or a Muslim or mm-hmm. a Hindu or a Sikh. There's plenty of choice in religion. There's different religions. There's different mm-hmm. sects and divisions within and denominations within each religion.
Right.
But in science, there isn't. There's mm-hmm. just one that's mm-hmm. supposed to be the same all over the world. So it's actually much more dictatorial and much more restrictive of free thought than anything in religion. And the paradox is that a lot of people who believe in the religion of science like to pretend this is free thought, whereas religion and every other system of thinking is not free thought, it's all dogma. So I think it's actually worse than religion
mm-hmm.
In terms of dogmatism, and additionally worse because most people who are being dogmatic don't even realize it. They think they know the truth.
Right.
Everyone else has beliefs, but they know the truth.
I wasn't alive back then, but back in the 15th or 16th century in Italy, I've read where Galileo had a lot of trouble with the established scientific and church communities, because he argued that the Earth was not the center of the universe. It was in the solar system. It was one of several different planets around the sun, and I think he was threatened with death. He had the same kind of problem with dogmatism in the scientific community for his new ideas.
Well, I think so. I mean, one of these supposed things that happened is he said to the cardinals who were attacking him, well, you say there's no moons around Jupiter. Well, just take a look through this telescope. They refused to look through the telescope. Now, it's actually very similar in contemporary science. If there's any data that don't fit the dogmas, they won't look at the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there's lots of evidence for telepathy.
Oh, yeah.
But most scientists who are against it simply refuse to look at the evidence. They're not interested in looking at it because they think it must be wrong.
Right.
And it's extraordinary that in the 21st century we're still in that situation.
Sure.
I myself try not to waste much energy worrying about this. I just sort of get on with doing research
mm-hmm.
in these areas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually much more fun to do research in areas that are very little explored than in overpopulated areas of science.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. The other issues that you have brought up is that science can't deal with the fact that we're conscious, and you argue that you've written that the experience is not inside your brain. What you're seeing is not in your mind. We project out the images which we're seeing, which is happening, some feel, outside of us, not within our mind, right, within our brain.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's part of the idea. I think that consciousness is the mind is a system of fields.
Mm-hmm.
Fields are extended in space and time.
Mm-hmm.
The field concept was first introduced into science in the 19th century by Michael Faraday,
mm-hmm.
the idea of electrical and magnetic fields. In the 20th century, it was extended to gravitation by Einstein and to quantum theory. We now have quantum matter fields, we have gravitational fields, electrical and magnetic fields, and fields within the atomic nucleus. I think there are many more kinds of fields in nature as well, including the fields of minds.
Right.
And I think that when we look at something, I think this is a very simple point.
Mm-hmm.
According to the official theory, when you look at anything, right now I'm looking out of a window at some trees, the trees I'm seeing are supposed to be inside my brain. The light comes in through the eyes, changes, inverted images on the retinas, changes in the cone cells, impulses up the optic nerves, changes inside the brain. And then the brain is supposed to produce a kind of virtual reality display somewhere inside the head.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm seeing the trees inside my head. Mm-hmm. But But actually, that's not where I think I experienced them. I experienced them out there. And actually, I think the images I'm seeing are out there. I think that the light comes in through the eyes, changes happen in the brain, as described. But then we produce images which we project out to where things are. And so I think I'm projecting out these images of the trees to where the trees actually are. My mind reaches out to touch them. And there's a sense in which my mind is contacting through my fields of perception what I'm looking at. And that should mean that I can affect what I'm looking at just by looking at it.
That's true.
And that should be true of people as well. Mm-hmm. If I look at someone from behind and that person doesn't know I'm there, I should be able to affect them just by looking at them.
Sure.
And in fact, there's a huge amount of evidence that this is true. People can often tell when they're being looked at from behind.
Right.
Even when they don't know there's another person there.
That's right.
I wrote about this extensively in a book I wrote called The Sense of Being Stared At,
mm-hmm.
Which is about the experimental evidence that people and animals can tell when they're being looked at. And I think this is because our minds project out. Another way in which it's so obvious, so common that we take it completely for granted, another way we wrote that we experience this is when we look at anything in a mirror. If you look in a mirror, the images you're seeing appear to be behind the mirror, but of course they're not really there. In science, they're called virtual images.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's happening is when we look into a mirror, our projections go straight through the mirror because they're in our minds, and our minds are not blocked by glass or by layers of mercury or the silvering mm-hmm. on the back of the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Our projections go right through the mirror. And what we're seeing when we look in the mirror is what we're projecting out. And the reason they're not where things actually are is the light's bent when it comes, when it's reflected by the mirror and comes into our eyes. But our outward projections are not bent because they're virtual. They're not material in the same sense of light or physical. They go straight through the mirror. So I think our experience of mirrors is direct evidence from our direct everyday experience of the fact we're projecting out what we see.
Fascinating. Just fascinating. It's so interesting to talk to you, Rupert. You mentioned Faraday waves before. Could you explain a little bit about those? I know that you've written a paper on by Merlin Sheldrake and yourself on the determinants of Faraday wave patterns in water. If you could explain that briefly, that would be great.
Well, this is a different phenomenon from all the other things I've been talking about so far.
Mm-hmm.
This is something discovered by Michael Faraday, who was the person who discovered fields, but mm-hmm. he was a kind of scientific polymath and discovered a lot of things. And one of the things he discovered is that if you vibrate fluids up and down, they form standing wave patterns on the surface, which mm-hmm. are called Faraday waves.
Mm-hmm.
They're named after Faraday. He didn't call them that, but other people have done since then.
Mm-hmm.
And if you vibrate things in a circular container, you get a whole series of very beautiful, complex, mandala-like images with different symmetries. At one frequency, you might have a fourfold pattern. At another frequency, a sixfold pattern. Another frequency, an eightfold pattern, and so on. And these tell us that vibrations can turn into form. Sound can turn into form. This is one of the basic principles of all religious traditions, that they all start with creative sounds, like the Hindu tradition. Mm-hmm. Speak about the creative sound or vibration underlying the universe. The book of Genesis also talks in terms of vibration. Chapter 1, verse 1, you know, the Spirit of God moved on the face of the deep or the face of the waters. And the Spirit is the wind. If the wind moves on the sea or the deep or the ocean, it produces waves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically very fundamental to all creation that there are these wave patterns. And in fact, I think morphic resonance happens because everything is basically vibratory or wave-like.
Mm-hmm.
So with my son Merlin, who has a PhD from Cambridge and is also a scientist, we've wrote this paper, which is online on my website together with all my other papers, mm-hmm. over 80 of them, mm-hmm. Available free. That's on www.sheldrake.org, my website. We've written a paper systematically investigating the various factors that affect these waves. And the reason we've done it is because forms coming about through vibration, I think, underlie virtually all of nature. So it's a very fundamental way of modeling the basic processes that underlie the appearance of forms in nature through vibration.
Fascinating. Yes, I downloaded your article, and it was just fascinating reading. Wow, just really interesting. One thing I wanted to run by you is you wrote a paper called The Replicability Crisis in Science, where it's very difficult sometimes to replicate the same phenomenon. And I'd love to have you talk about a little bit about that, if you could.
Yes, well, this is a very, very important issue. I discuss it in my book, Science Set Free. Mm-hmm. After the Ten Dogmas, mm-hmm. I have another chapter called Illusions of Objectivity.
Sure.
You see, one of the things about believers in the religion of science is that they say science is true, everything else is just a subjective belief, but science is true because everything can be replicated. Now, I've known for a long time as a practicing scientist that this is not the case. Even when I was a graduate student at Cambridge, we used to make fun of papers in scientific journals because people would usually show some beautiful graph of the results and say typical results are shown in figure one or representative data are shown in figure two. We always knew it wasn't really representative or typical. People publish their best results. If they have experiments that give ambiguous or muddled results or there's no clear picture, they usually don't publish them. They remain in a file drawer. And I did a survey to find out what percentage of their data scientists actually publish. In many branches of science, it's no more than 5 or 10%. Now, if you only had to declare 5 or 10% of your income or expenses on your Internal Revenue Service tax return, obviously you could give a very distorted picture of what's happening.
Sure.
And I think this has been happening routinely in science for decades.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole thing blew up a couple of years ago in what's now called the replication crisis or the replicability or the reproducibility crisis.
Mm-hmm.
An American drug company found that they were spending billions of dollars without getting very useful results in their research. And they tried to figure out why. And they asked the scientists what's going on. And they said, well, the trouble is we're basing our research on these fundamental findings in molecular biology,
mm-hmm.
and in other biomedical sciences. But the papers we're basing them on just don't seem to work out, and it doesn't seem that we can replicate them.
Mm-hmm.
And the scientists, on the whole, blamed themselves. So what the company did, they were smart. They said, okay, give us a list of the 50 most important papers that your research is based on. So they gave them a list. And then they commissioned an independent laboratory to replicate these 50 studies. And it turned out that 46 out of 50, that's 92%, could not be replicated.
Mm.
Only 4 out of 50, 8%, could be replicated.
My goodness. Wow.
And at first they thought there must be some mistake.
Right.
But then another drug company commissioned a similar study using other papers, again with similar results. Then people in psychology got a list of the 200 most influential papers and had an international attempt to replicate them, and more than 60% of those couldn't be replicated.
Mm-hmm.
Then it went to social psychology, even chemistry. It turns out large amounts of published literature in the sciences cannot be replicated. Mm-hmm. And so that's why there's a crisis within science.
Mm-hmm.
And the reasons, I think, are fairly clear. They're the reasons I set out in my chapter called Illusions of Objectivity, that if you only publish a small amount of your data, and if your entire career in science depends on getting papers published in top journals. You don't want to publish papers that are muddled or that have confused or muddled results. You want ones that publish ones that look good, and that will get you ahead and that will get you promoted. So in a sense, people who do this are actually the people who rise to the top in science.
Oh, I see.
So the entire system has an inherent problem within it.
Right.
And that's why I've never seen a crisis of this magnitude within science.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a huge amount of discussion of this within scientific journals like Nature. There's a lot of sort of heart-rending sort of discussions and you know, chest beating and stuff within science. It's a humility has set in among professional scientists that I've never seen
mm-hmm.
before.
Mm-hmm.
This hasn't, of course, affected the internet troll types who believe in the religion of science because they don't actually know much about this kind
right.
of thing.
Right.
They've just got a rather simple belief system. But for professional scientists, this is now a major problem. And people are setting in place all sorts of ways to try and deal with it.
Right.
One of them involves pre-registering studies that you do. You say in advance what you're going to do and what kind of statistical analysis you're going to do.
Mm.
And rather than only publishing selected results afterwards, these measures may or may not improve the situation. We don't know yet. But anyway, all is not well in the garden of science at the moment. There's a very serious problem.
My goodness.
And it's to do with the publish or perish system
sure.
on which scientific careers are based.
Sure, sure. Very quickly, Michiko, since she's here, if you could tell us maybe 2 minutes on what Dr. Moto ran into in replicating water crystals.
Okay.
I know you have an opinion on that.
Yes. Dr. Moto went through this exactly the same problem because he was asked if, can you duplicate the water crystal photographs. And he always said he tried, and the result was he could not really duplicate the same crystals. And he came to the point where he started to say that the whole world, even though we have 7 billion people, there's no one who is exactly the same as someone else, even identical twins. So that shows that nature is never exactly the same. You cannot duplicate the same thing in nature. So we were just, he was not an obviously scientist, but he came to the point where we could not duplicate the same water crystals. And he had the hard time given by the many scientists. So that's the
same issue.
Yeah.
Same issue. Well, I think, Rupert, you've hit it right on the head. Getting rid of these documents would really help discover the truth. And I have to ask you, what do you see for the future for us in terms of what you think science will come around and finally recognize the limitations of the dogmas?
Well, the trouble is that at the moment the career structure in science is based on more of the same, you know,
uh-huh.
just incremental improvements. If you do anything very radical in science, it's very hard to get it funded or published
sure.
or to build a career on it.
Right.
Most people are deliberately conservative because they're concerned about getting their grants renewed or having their careers furthered.
Right.
And to play along with the existing system is
right.
the safest way to do that.
Sure.
If you do something radical or really new or innovative, you'll probably ruin your scientific career.
Right.
I have letters all the time from graduate students who want to do PhDs on things like morphic resonance and mm-hmm. telepathy and asking my advice. And I have to be honest with them. I have to say right now, it's very difficult to build a career doing this kind of science mm-hmm. because the money and the jobs are not there.
Sure.
But one of the things that I think could make a big difference is private funding. If you go through existing institutions, National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, that kind of thing, then you're subject to all these very conservative forces. But fortunately, there are now a lot of extremely wealthy people, and a few of them are actually interested in science. And they could make a huge difference if they actually funded radical research. And probably the most important initiative in this is based in Seattle. It's called the Institute for Venture Science. Oh,
Professor Pollack, of course.
That's Jerry Pollack's thing. And Jerry Pollack is a professor at the University of Washington.
Right.
And Jerry has set up this body called the Institute for Venture Science.
Yeah.
That the aim is to fund radical research that regular research funding will not fund, because he thinks that's the way to trigger a whole new wave of innovation.
Right.
And they've already appealed for grant proposals. They've already had a whole set of grant proposals. They've been evaluated for truly radical research. Mm-hmm. The problem is they haven't yet got the billionaires to put in the money. And actually, for a billionaire, radical research is usually quite cheap. You know, $20 million would probably revolutionize science as we know it.
Absolutely.
And for someone who's got $20 billion, that's pocket money. Mm-hmm. You know, small change.
Right.
So any billionaire who really wants to make a difference can make a difference and could actually transform science. And Jerry Pollack at the University of Washington got the perfect platform for doing this.
Yeah. Well, I can't say enough good things about Jerry Pollack. He's a good friend of mine, and I do whatever I can to support him in his research. And I think you're a great scientist, too, Sheldrick, and a very brave one, too, for stepping out. And I think, you know, you have to look at, I think, what you said before about if we can get rid of these dogmas, then science will truly help discover the truth. People are tired of dogma. They're tired of things which are religious-like. I mean, what's the purpose of science? Is the purpose of science just brainwashing people into age-old dogmas that have gone on for thousands of years, or is it truly a time to find the truth? And I think most people on this planet are certainly interested in finding the truth.
Yes, and funny enough, even quite a lot of scientists are. If you talk to scientists after work, you know, after a glass of beer or something in the evening, they're much more open-minded very often in private than they are in public, because in public, they feel they have to pretend to be conventional and stuff.
Sure.
They don't want to lose their grant or damage their reputation.
Sure.
I compare it to Russia under Brezhnev. You know, years ago in the Soviet period, anyone who dissented from the communist system would lose their job, or if they dissented strongly enough, they'd be put in a psychiatric institution. Right now, it's a bit like that in science, and people in Russia kept quiet. If they were not card-carrying communists, at least they pretended that they agreed with it in public. And I think we've got a similar situation in science where people feel they have to pretend to agree with this, even if they don't, simply because that's the way to make their career stay on track.
Right.
But when the communist empire collapsed in Russia, how many people were true believing communists? There were some, but they were certainly not a majority.
Very few.
And I think when the mechanistic system, this mechanistic materialism that we have at the moment dominating science, when these dogmas break down, we'll find that there are some scientists who believe in them for sure. People like Richard Dawkins, for example. But there are an awful lot of scientists who don't, and I think who will find this change very liberating.
Well, it can't come soon enough. It can't come soon enough, Rupert. We've got about a minute left, and I want to give you the rest of the time to wrap up your wonderful interview today.
Well, I should mention that I'm doing a talk this evening and a workshop tomorrow with my wife, Jill Purse.
Wonderful.
That's at East West Books. The talk this evening's at Fremont Abbey Arts Center.
Okay.
Anyone who'd like to read more about my ideas about science, take a look at Science Set Free, which is where I summarize a lot of what I've been talking about today. And then on August the 28th, my new book, Science and Spiritual Practices, comes out. And in the meantime, anyone who wants to follow up or read more about what I've done, including looking at more about my talks, peer-reviewed papers, etc., etc., there's a huge amount of material on my website, which is sheldrake.org, S-H-E-L-D-R-A-K-E.org.
Wonderful.
O-R-G.
Wonderful. Well, Rupert, I hope you have a wonderful and happy time here in the Seattle area, and thank you again so much for your wonderful work. You're enlightening all of humanity with your fabulous research. Thank you so much.
A pleasure, Ted. Very good to talk to you.
Wonderful to talk to you too, Sheldrick. Bye-bye and Godspeed.